Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 2 years ago, my aunt died of multiple myeloma. The cancer had invaded almost all the bone marrow in her body. Countless tiny fractures rendered her spine as fragile and brittle as, I guess, a cracked piece sheet of ice. And she was in a lot of pain. She couldn't move, and I'm not even sure she had the strength or clarity of mind to smile because she was on so many drugs at the time. I didn't get to see her when she died because my family had shuttled her from continent to continent, hospital to hospital, trying to find the doctor that could cure her incurable disease. And Anthony, I'm sharing this because it was only after my aunt died that I really began to wonder, did we, her family, ever really know what she wanted? I mean, I'm not actually even sure we ever talked about it, or at least talked about it clearly.
Yeah, my guess is lots and lots of families don't talk about this. It's a difficult conversation for a lot of families to have, but of course it's one that a lot of us are going to have to face sooner or later.
Yeah, and I mean, frankly, I miss my aunt terribly, and what makes it worse is that I really don't know if this woman that we all loved so much died the way she wanted to.
Well, as we know, millions of families go through similar heartbreaking experiences every year. A loved one is diagnosed with a terminal illness, and it's time to have that conversation about end-of-life care. It's a difficult one to have. By one measure, fewer than 30% of Americans say they have some kind of medical advance directive specifying what kind of care they want in their final days.
So today, we're going to have a conversation about having that difficult conversation. Because right now, there is an active legislative effort on Beacon Hill that would require healthcare providers to offer information and counseling to patients about their end-of-life options. We'll start today with this report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger.
Senate aides who knew what was coming held their breath as Senate President Therese Murray asked the clerk to read Amendment Number 121.
Palliative care awareness.
Question comes on adoption of the amendment. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted.
In the absence of objections, Murray barely glances up as the Senate approves a requirement that physicians and nurses in Massachusetts talk to dying patients about their end-of-life options, their risks and benefits, and how best to manage their symptoms and pain. Almost 3 years ago, Sarah Palin claimed that such counseling could turn into death panels.
I picture it as a panel of bureaucrats deciding who will receive that care.
Here's Palin on Sean Hannity's radio show.
Of years left of productive life, and that's a cruel and evil way of allowing Americans to receive the health care coverage that they want.
What Americans National want controversy about death panels, what AARP called lies about death panels, is completely misguided.
Dr. Lachlan Farrow directs ethics and palliative care programs at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center.
And in Massachusetts, we can unite and show how to do it right.
Farrow chaired an expert panel on end-of-life care that wrapped up last year. The Senate amendment is a first step towards filling the panel's recommendations. Farrow says there's widespread agreement in Massachusetts that to make sure patients get the care they want, they must be informed about their options.
Life prolonging, as long as it might work in the intensive care unit, might be a choice. Or I just want to be home with my family as comfortable as possible. People need to know the full range of choices. That needs to be documented if they have preferences, and it has to be respected absolutely all the time.
And that's the next step, says Farrow, to train hospital and home care staff about how to follow a patient's wishes. I called Senate Republican leaders to confirm that they had no objections to this amendment. Outside the statehouse, Chris Mino, president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, endorses the amendment with one caveat.
We do have concerns down the road that, God forbid, should the physician-assisted suicide referendum pass on the ballot in November, this could open up a Pandora's box.
Mino would oppose requiring that doctors counsel patients about the option of physician-assisted suicide. But broad support for end-of-life discussions with doctors begs the question, why is reception for this issue so different in the Bay State?
People in Massachusetts are smarter than everywhere else. No, seriously.
Senator Richard Moore is one of the sponsors of the amendment on end-of-life and pain management counseling.
We approached it in the right way, bringing in people who had experience with it and not to to demonize anybody in the process. And I think that's a big part of it.
Moore stresses that the state would not require that patients make end-of-life plans or even have the conversation if they don't want to. Under the Senate plan, the state would consult with the Hospice Federation of Massachusetts on information and guidelines for counseling patients. This issue is only in the Senate health care costs bill right now. House leaders declined to say if they would support such an amendment when the House takes up their version of the health care cost legislation.
That report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger. So, listeners, do you think a government requirement is the way to get doctors and patients talking about end-of-life care? Have you had to go through this yourself or maybe with a loved one? Do you feel like you knew what all your options were? And doctors, do you even feel like you know how to talk with your patients about how they may want to deal with their final days? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a comment at our website. That's radioboston.org. Well, we're joined now by Deborah Dalloway of the Hospice and Palliative Care Federation of Massachusetts. Deborah is also the administrator of the hospital-based Cranberry Hospice and Palliative Care Group in Plymouth. Deborah Dalloway, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Jane DeLima Thomas, Associate Director of the Harvard Palliative Medicine Fellowship. Dr. Thomas, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Deborah Dalloway, let me start with you. It's the Hospice and Palliative Care Federation of Massachusetts that's in part, if this becomes law, that will be charged with helping formulate guidelines on how these conversations should happen. So, let me first ask you: do you feel that government legislation is what's required to get people to start talking about end of life care?
Well, I think it's a sort of sad comment that we haven't been able to do it without some sort of regulation or guidance from the government. I guess at this point I would say that I think that whenever you have a lot of variation in how care is delivered and you know what you want your outcome to be and you're not able to get there, sometimes you have to have someone step in and help say, this is what needs to happen.
Dr. Thomas, I don't want to dwell too much on previous political precedents, as Martha Biebinger did touch upon in her piece. But I do have to ask you, I mean, part of the concern that that exploded when the whole quote-unquote death panels thing was brought up several years ago was that these were the kinds of government efforts that might get us at the top of that slippery slope of government becoming part of the conversation itself when it comes to what options are available, what options would be paid for when it comes to end-of-life care. I mean, do you still think that's a valid concern?
I think for those of us who deal on a daily basis with patients who have serious and life-limiting illnesses, we see these kinds of conversations as empowering patients to make choices and really having a sense of what their options are instead of, in a crisis situation, merely responding to what's happening in the moment when decisions are often fraught and it's hard to get any sense of perspective on them. So I think while I understand that there's this concern that having these kinds of conversations can lead to limitations or rationing, I think for the clinicians who work with patients every day, we see this as really an effort to empower patients to be able to have a say in what happens to them. Mm. Otherwise, the default is that patients will receive the most aggressive, intensive, sometimes intrusive care, and that's done without their consent or being able to choose that.
Mm-hmm. And one last sort of political question that I have for both of you is what we heard Chris Mino say in Martha Biebinger's report, that it is interesting that, okay, this has not become law. It's only an amendment in the Senate side of the healthcare cost control bill, so we don't know what's going to happen yet. But he noted that this is happening in the same year where there's a ballot question in Massachusetts that gives voters the chance to vote on physician-assisted suicide. So his concern was that if you have the two come together, we may end up in a world in Massachusetts where, in part of that end-of-life conversation that will be, that may be mandated by this state, physicians would also be saying, one of your options is physician-assisted suicide. Deborah Dalloway, do you feel that as a valid concern?
Well, I suppose it is a valid concern. The ballot question has not passed yet either. So I think we got a lot of ifs into this equation. I suppose, you know, what we really hope is that people see the full range of their options. And I guess from the Hospice and Palliative Care Federation, we do stand opposed to the death with dignity, mostly because we think it polarizes people. And I think this is what we're all trying to say. We don't want to inflame people. We don't want to bring up, oh, these are the big differences and the problems. We really want everyone to come to the place where they're all trying to work toward better end-of-life care. And so I think I would rather sort of stay away from what might divide us and more move toward what can unite us.
Well, we're talking about having that difficult conversation about medical options regarding end-of-life care and a legislative effort on Beacon Hill that may require doctors and patients to talk about planning their final days. You can join us with your thoughts and personal experiences at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Deborah Dalloway and Dr. Jane DeLima Thomas, I'd like to take a step back, actually, and ask what may seem to be an ignorant question. But right now, when we're talking about end-of-life care, I mean, that seems to me it can mean anything from, you know, the actual treatment that you receive in your final days to the types or strategies of medication that you undergo from the beginning of a diagnosis of what may be a terminal disease. I mean, is it as broad as that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think the term end-of-life care can be very broad. You know, for those of us, I'm a palliative care physician, which means I help seriously ill patients with life-limiting illness. I practice in the hospital setting. So for me, I see my job beginning when someone receives a diagnosis of a life-limiting illness. It doesn't have to be when they're imminently dying. It doesn't have to be when they're transitioning to hospice. It can be helping with symptom management, with helping their families cope, with guiding them through some of these difficult conversations and difficult decision-making. And I think I believe that that care is only enhanced the earlier that palliative care clinicians or this type of focus can be introduced into the care of a patient.
Do we know what effect it has when patients do receive this type of early counseling or conversations where they can get this kind of information? Do we know what effect it has on their well-being through the course of their treatment?
There have been, and you can maybe speak to this better than I, but there have been a number of recent studies where patients have less anxiety. They often live longer because we're treating not only their physical symptoms, but their emotional, their spiritual distress. So I think we do know that it doesn't take away hope, which is something we hear all the time from people. And we're not going to tell them that because that will take away their hope. But what that really means is that you're making them go through this journey without a professional guidance. They're really alone in that journey. So I think when you put the care into the equation early on, it can only enhance their prognosis and their quality of life.
And I guess what I would add is that one of the major purposes of having these conversations has been shown to actually to happen, which is that patients, when they're asked what their preferences for treatment are, when they have those conversations earlier, the outcomes that we see are that the care they receive is closer to what their stated wishes are. And so without these conversations, we find that they receive care that they don't want. And I think that's one of the most important things. But other outcomes are, as Deborah alluded to, they have patients who have these conversations end up having a better quality of life, which means reduced physical and emotional distress. They have reduced hospital stays and ICU stays. Mm-hmm. And they have increased outcomes for their family members as well.
For their for those who would survive them.
Yeah.
Dr. Thomas, let me ask you, what about from the physician's perspective? Because I imagine, I mean, doctors aren't trained to, quote unquote, let go themselves. They're trained to do the exact opposite. They're trained to heal and try to do everything to save lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, it must be difficult to sort of break through that mindset and say, now you also have to talk about the possibility of not being able to pull off that miracle.
I think that's exactly right. I think physicians find this very, very difficult. And I think, you know, one thing that you just said really speaks to how I think about this work and I think about these conversations, which is the distinction between curing and healing. And so, you know, our patients are increasingly surviving what used to be a devastating, life-limiting illness, especially traumatic sort of emergencies or injuries or infections or things that used to mean that someone would die. And so we are increasingly faced with patients who are now living with chronic illness and having sort of slower declines, living later. And so I think this issue of how to help people live as well as possible for as long as possible really rests on having these conversations and physicians shifting gears from how do we cure disease or how do we cure a medical problem to how do we help healing for this patient and this family as they progress through the illness.
It's not an easy set of gears to shift, though, I imagine.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you more about that in a minute, but we have a lot of callers who want to join us, so let's get them into this conversation. Kate is calling from Bedford. You're on the air, Kate.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm just this topic is so incredibly important to me. I unfortunately just lost both my parents within the last year and a half and went through the incredible experience of watching both had living wills, both had powers of attorney, all the legal things you could have in place. However, you know, I was struck by how, although he gave great care and was an incredibly amazing doctor to my father, that my father's oncologist really wasn't willing to have or wasn't able to have that conversation with my father. And so what I went through in the end of his life, being in the ICU and ultimately getting him to hospice and having to fight other family members to do that, was so incredibly painful. And the flip side is that then I went through the exact same experience with my mother and knew exactly what to ask for, knew exactly what to say. And as soon as I did it, the, you know, the palliative care team came in another equally sized hospital in Philadelphia. And I was, I didn't have to jump through quite so many hoops.
Kate, so
I knew what to ask.
I'm sorry, Kate. I just want to jump here because I want to be sure I understand you correctly. Even though your father basically had all the legal paperwork that was that I suppose stipulated what he wanted, because you didn't have that conversation, or he and you didn't have that conversation with the medical team beforehand, he may have not gotten it until you fought for it. But the only difference that ended up helping your mother get what she wanted is that you did talk about it earlier with the medical team.
Well, I think it was a crisis situation, as many of these things have, you know, happen. And I had one physician who was caring for her, who of all the team of people, you know, with all their brilliance and their care and their love. However, you know, there until the family member says, you know, that's it, I don't want any more invasive care, you know, obviously they're not going to do that. So I had one physician who came to me who said, she's not, you know, it's only going to get more invasive from here on out. And because I knew that that's what my mother wanted, was to not have, you know, terribly invasive care at the end of her life, I was able to say, okay, let's stop. And
Kate,
let's let's make her comfortable.
Kate, thank you so much for your call. Deborah Dalloway, let me ask you, it sounds like Kate's story teaches us a lesson that the conversation is just the beginning, that patients will still need to actually essentially be, it helps them get them closer down the path of the care they want, but it doesn't stop them from needing to be their own advocates in the system for as long as they're in the medical system.
Correct. That's correct. And I think maybe part of what we're talking about here today is how do we standardize the power of the patient's conversation in ways that we haven't done so far. I mean, it sounds like in the second instance there was a palliative care team, so it was a little easier for her to make her mother's wishes known. But I think that it's very true that no matter, you do need to have that conversation, like the doctor has said, prior to it being a crisis. But then it does go sort of against the stream of the traditional medical system, so it isn't always easy.
So follow-up question on that. What happens when maybe members of the medical team themselves, even though they know it's quite a dire diagnosis, what happens if a patient says after this conversation, I don't really want any treatment, and every fiber of the doctor's body says, but we can do something? I mean, there's a tension there, is there not, Dr. Thomas?
There is. I think that the way that I see my role is to really learn very carefully what the clinical reality is for this particular patient and what the prognosis is, and then to learn with equal care who this patient is and what values this patient has and what priorities this patient has. And that way I'm much better able to understand why the patient is saying what he or she is about choices that he or she's making about the different options for treatment. And I can then advocate for that patient and family in a way that I couldn't if I didn't understand their
understand
motivation.
There, for example, you had a patient who said that he wanted every heroic measure taken, including intubation in his final days. And after really talking with him about what he wanted, his greatest value was that he didn't want to see as being one who had given up.
Yeah, yeah. So I took care of this young man who had a very aggressive cancer, a relatively new diagnosis, and his family was still grappling with this terrible reality. And he became increasingly short of breath and was faced with this decision about whether to be put on a ventilator or on a breathing machine. And the team was very concerned that if he went on the ventilator, he wouldn't be able to come off it and that the family would be left with a terrible choice down the road. And because he and I had this conversation and I understood what his motivation was, which was to, if there was any chance at all that he could survive this, to give this, to do everything possible just so that his mother would know he did everything, he was a fighter, and that she would be able to then grieve holding on to that. And what that meant was because we had that conversation, he pursued this aggressive treatment, hoping that, you know, we might be able to get him through. And when it became clear that we couldn't, his mother was then able to permit the mm-hmm. withdrawing of these machines because we'd had these conversations up front.
Let's take one more call. Mara's calling from Newberry. You're on the air, Mara.
Hi, thank you very much. I was kind of puzzled when I heard the beginning of this conversation because I've worked in three different Boston area hospitals, and my last best example is for 8 years I've been a patient quality care specialist. And my experience has been that this conversation always happens. It's not forced on the patient, but that the doctor does go into the room, you know, and many doctors aren't comfortable with it, but they do it. They go in and they ask about especially end-of-life options and aggressive treatment, and if it does look like it's becoming a, you know, a crisis situation, they do talk about intubation.
So, Mara, are you wondering why a law is necessary in this case?
Yes, I am. I think more conversation has to take place, but I also feel that it has come down, in my experience, more to family than patients. Sometimes patients are very willing to let go because they, you know, they're in reality of their condition, and the doctors and the nursing staff mm-hmm. also are on board with that, and there will be a family member that will absolutely, positively say, absolutely not.
you have to do every single thing.
Mara, let's take up your point, because I'd like to turn it to our guests here. Deborah Dalloway, Mara's asking a good question. If this is a growing trend within hospitals itself, as it is, why, I mean, I guess come back to the original question, why have a government law? And also, it's not just a conversation between the patients and the doctors.
Correct. I mean, I think part of this amendment that is in the in the Senate now is about general end-of-life palliative care education for the community and for the physicians themselves and for, you know, just the wider, widening up the conversation that people really understand what their choices are. And I don't disagree that a lot of doctors will have the conversation. I think there are many that don't have the conversation for a variety of reasons. I think I said in the very beginning, I don't think any of us would have hoped that we would come here, mm-hmm. but I do think we know what we want for outcomes. And a simple thing would be, you know, there are about 70% of the population, when asked in a recent study, said they would like to die at home. And yet in Massachusetts, 70% of the patients die either in a hospital or a nursing home. So somewhere we're losing the opportunity to have that conversation early enough to make an impact on how that happens.
Well, we've just begun the conversation here today. And listeners, I strongly encourage you to continue it, because I'd love to hear and read your stories online at radioboston.org. Deborah Dalloway, Vice President of the Board of Directors at the Hospice and Palliative Care Federation of Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dr. Jane DeLima Thomas, Associate Director of the Harvard Palliative Medicine Fellowship, thank you as well for your time.
Thank you.
Listeners, stay with us, because coming up, we are going to turn the corner and talk some sports. Plus, Dan Zevin on his new book, Dan Gets a Minivan, Life at the Intersection of Dude and Dad. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.